Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 71 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. This is the Falklands Air War, Part 2. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace
Argentina
Magazine.
Has invaded
Tim, how are
the
you?
Falklands.
I'm very well, thank you, Peter.
2,000 men are reported to have gone
excellent
ashore
stuff,
this morning.
Excellent
and
stuff,
taken
excited about
control.
Another episode on
the
Falklands.
Are to
and Gareth, the
soon.
Executive
Senior
Editor
at
Global
at
Aviation Resource. He is, of course,
RAF
Gareth Stringer. Gareth, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks.
You're listening to Extended.
And we're joined again by Naval Air Historian Matt Willis. Matt, welcome back to Extended.
Peter, thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you all back with me for this second part to the Falklands Air War. Very excited about this one. Really enjoyed the last episode, so excited to get on with this. But first, I'd like to say to you that this episode is brought to you with the kind support of Navy Wings.
Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 71 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. This is the Falklands Air War, Part 2. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Peter. Nice to be back.
Yep, excellent stuff, excellent stuff. Excited about another episode on the Falklands. And Gareth, the Executive Editor at Global Aviation Resource, he is, of course, Gareth Stringer. Gareth, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Very good. And we're joined again by Naval Air Historian Matt Willis. Matt, welcome back to Extended.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you all back with me for this second part to the Falklands Air War. Very excited about this one. Really enjoyed the last episode, so excited to get on with this. But first, I'd like to say to you that this episode is brought to you with the kind support of Navy Wings. Navy Wings is the brand of the Fly Navy Heritage Trust charity, which operates and supports the Sea Vixen, Two Swordfish, Sea Fury T20 and more. The charity relies on public donations to keep the nation's historic naval aircraft in the skies as a focus of remembrance and inspire future generations. Sign up as a supporter to take advantage of unique benefits. These include visits to the Heritage Hangar, entry into prize draws to win a flight in one of the Heritage aircraft, and discounted Yeovilton Air Day tickets with access to the exclusive Navy Wings enclosure. This episode is dedicated to all of those who did not come home. Okay, let's get on with today's feature. Tim, you got to speak to Commander Ward.
This year, it is 35 years since the Falklands War in 1982. We saw the UK dispatch a naval task force which successfully recaptured the island. At the very tip of the spear back in 1982 was the Fleet Air Arms Sea Harrier fighters, who defended the Royal Navy task force from air attack at odds of 20 to 1. Without the Sea Harrier and its pilots, it is difficult to imagine how Britain would win that conflict and successfully recaptured the Falklands. It's therefore an honour to have an extended what might well be described as one of the last British fighter aces. That is Commander Nigel Sharkey McCartan Ward, DSC, AFC, Royal Navy, retired on the show with us. He commanded 801 Naval Air Squadron on HMS Invincible in the Falklands War and was the joint leading air ace with 3 confirmed air-to-air kills and flew over 60 combat missions. He's the author of Sea Harrier Over the Falklands, A Maverick at War. Commander Ward, welcome to Extended.
Thank you so much, Tim. Good to be here.
Thanks so much. You know, taking time out to come talk to us. Let's rewind a bit at first. I mean, what inspired you to become a pilot in the first place?
Well, my father was in the Royal Air Force. He was a sergeant fitter on Merlin engines during World War II, and was an equipment officer. And I went around the country and part of the world with him as a growing lad. And the most impressive thing we were up at in the Rutland, watching the Black Arrows fly every day, Roger Top, and the Black Arrows were the formation team before the Red Arrows. And from our little farmhouse that we rented near the air station, we just look across the valley and watch these guys doing their thing each day, and it was quite amazing. You had a free air show every day while they practiced. And that was the main instigator. But then I went to Singapore to visit my parents, and we went out the islands to Penang and went on board one of Her Majesty's aircraft carriers, HMS Albion, I believe it was, for a cocktail party, and to see all these bronzed superstar aviators on the flight deck alongside massive aircraft, and the guys dressed in pristine white shorts and sharkskin shirts and epaulettes and whatever, was quite telling. And that really convinced me that, wow, I think that's what I want to do, because I want to fly. And the most demanding form of flying in the world is from the deck of an aircraft carrier. So that's really what started me and what I wanted to do.
Fantastic. So let's walk through your naval career before Operation Corporate and Sea Harrier. So you flew Sea Vixens and the mighty F4 Phantoms. What was it like moving from sort of twin-engine, twin-seat carrier aircraft to single-seat, single-engine Shah?
Well, it was quite a change. To get everything in perspective, I was only on Vixen's holding in 899 Squadron, pending going to the 1st Phantom Squadron in 1969. So I didn't embark in a carrier with a Vixen, although I loved flying it for a period. That's also the time I got court-martialed for low flying, but that's another story. the Phantom was the beast of the day. It was the Rolls-Royce of the country. And indeed, Rolls-Royce gave our squadron 892 a nice red Rolls-Royce to run around in going to the pub. So it was an amazing experience climbing into a Phantom and launching and with all that power behind you. And eventually, I was the senior pilot of 892 squadron on board HMS Ark Royal. I done everything that could possibly want to do in the Phantom. And so it was really convenient to move on to another era. I was sent to the Ministry of Defense, much to my horror. I had no training for it, or very little, and sat on the Sea Harrier desk. So I learned all about the aircraft by introducing it to service as the main desk officer responsible for it under more senior officers, of course. And so I knew the aircraft inside out by the time I went to fly the Harrier to learn how to fly the jump jet after leaving the mod. And the most amazing thing about it was sitting in a two-seat aircraft before I learned to fly the aircraft with a Navy test pilot flying the aircraft and coming in to land on board HMS Hermes during the Sea Harrier trials. And it was a shock, not coming in at 140 knots, 160 miles an hour, to bang down on the deck, but to suddenly slow down in airy fairyland and be there hovering like a helicopter alongside this massive carrier, then moving over and touching down. It was totally unreal, and you can't imagine what a shock it was to the system, because you felt, you know, this isn't right.
Fantastic.
So when I went to fly the Harrier for 30 hours at RAF Wittering, and they, the RAF Harrier boys, gave us all very good training preparing to go into the Harrier, Sea Harrier world. We taught them a thing or two about fighter combat while we were there, but they taught us everything about flying the Harrier, and that was extremely good fun. We were very well looked after, and it prepared us very well for the start of the Sea Harrier world, where you're a single-seat guy, and indeed we were then going to expand the Harrier from a ground attack aircraft to an all-weather or multi-role aircraft, with the principal aim being to get it quite good as a fighter aircraft and an interceptor, even though we were only going to have short-range sidewinder missiles. So, yeah, it was a shock to the system going to the Sea Harrier, but a very nice shock. It was challenging. You can land a Harrier in 8 different ways without landing it on a runway. So you can imagine it's a workload that you have to get used to. And when you're flying single seat at night in war, trying to attack a ground target or a surface target, that's one of the most demanding things you can do. So it was a challenge, and we all sort of like challenges. We're a bit gung-ho air warfare instructors and Navy fighter pilots. And so it was an exciting challenge for us all, and we all thoroughly enjoyed what we were doing. And we got the best possible backup from First Sea Lord Sir Henry Leach and others on the route going to the Falklands War, which was only 3 years after we received the first aircraft.
That's right, yeah. So when did the nickname Sharky come about? Was that obviously everyone in the military gets a nickname? How did you acquire that?
Well, we get nicknames for flying when we're doing domestic flying. I also use nicknames during the Falklands War, of course, as you might know. Sharky, I now know where it came from. I didn't know where it came from before, but wards in the service. Ratings in particular, non-commissioned officers and ratings, if their name was Ward, their nickname would be Sharky.
Oh.
But it wasn't usual for officers to be called Sharky because it was sort of infra-dig, And so they christened me Sharky in the squadron. I thought the Fleet Air Arm roughed up my corners, but in fact I think I roughed up the Fleet Air Arm's corners because I was a bit rough already. And so Sharky fitted very well, but now I know where it came from. The Barbary Coast in the old days, where there were two pirates called Sharky with captaining ships. One was a true pirate and buccaneer type. The other one was a disgraced Royal Navy officer who went to the Barbary Coast and started his own business as a pirate. And that's where they were both called Ward, and their nicknames were Sharky, and we continued it from there.
Excellent. So we're now 35 years on from Operation Corporate. What are your main memories of the Falklands War? What stands out for you?
Well, so many things, but if I have to look at just one or two, the first would be that nobody gave us a chance. I remember Air Vice Marshal Blue Rinse after his hair dye, coming on the television the weekend we were leaving with the task force, saying that the Navy stands no chance of success because they haven't got any air power at all, which was, of course, wrong. But all over the world, people were watching us, and nobody thought we were going to succeed except ourselves. And I think now my good friend, God bless him, he's died now, but Sandy Woodward, knew we were going to win. He had no doubts. And I had no doubts either, because we'd had such a good track record with our little aircraft, and it was so serviceable. It's always on the line ready for use. But we felt we had a fighting chance of beating the tremendous odds we were up against and protecting the task force and allowing our soldiers to do their job. So that was sort of the main memory. The other memory is of all the lads, whether they're in the ships, in the supporting ships, on land, in the Marines, the Paras, the Scots Guards, the Welsh Guards, the Gurkhas, all these young lads, average age 19 to 20, were the reason we won the war. We did our thing in the air, did our bit, but so did the warships doing bombarding inshore. So did the Admiral keeping us out of range of Exocet. And most importantly, so did the amphibious force put themselves in danger in San Carlos water and did a brilliant job under Brigadier Julian Thompson, who's a very good friend now, who guided the whole operation until Jeremy Moore flew out later and landed, yacht 70 miles to Port Stanley, and was never let down. Either the Admiral or the Mike Clatt, the amphibious commander, or the Brigadier, never let down by any of the guys. They were always there for us, working. You can't imagine the hours they worked and the conditions they worked in. So my main memory is the teamwork that existed. Without that teamwork, we could never have beaten the odds.
Yeah. You said about sort of obviously you know people thought that you couldn't possibly win. Why did people underestimate the Sea Harrier so much? I mean, was it kind of it's subsonic, or was it that partly to do with you were coming back with reports saying we it's fantastic, and yet maybe there are other of us people of a squadrons or of a test pilots saying that the radar doesn't work properly. We're not sure it's going to be a visual day fighter only, and if that.
Yes, well, there was a lot of politics involved in it, a lot of inter-service rivalry involved in it. Also, an inability of the Navy in particular, at all levels of staff, to read the reports that we put in about the aircraft during its trials, whether they were the initial flying trials, which I commanded, or the headquarters squadron trials, or the radar trials, all of which I commanded. And we put in enough reports to cover the runway at Yeovilton. With the engineering reports, of course, which were vast, and we were absolutely gobsmacked when I got down to the Falklands, when I realized that nobody had bloody well read the reports. The man in charge of, the senior aviator on the Admiral's staff who was advising him, knew bugger all about the aircraft. And he thought all it was good for was surface attack or ground attack. Same with the flag captain in charge of Hermes. And so there was the Admiral with a new staff that was given to him. He couldn't choose it. None of whom knew anything about the Sea Harrier. And that was reflected in the public knowledge, like Air Vice Marshal Manol saying, we haven't got any aircraft, any air power to protect the fleet. That was the word. And all the good reports that we put in, which had been acknowledged, indeed, by the aggressor squadron commanding officer and others, that we were a real threat in terms of fighter combat, within visual range fighter combat. Nobody could really beat us. This was not really understood at all by most levels within the Navy, because they just damn well didn't read the reports, which has shocked me. And it reminded me that when I was in the MOD, I was always a bit of a maverick, and we were having an intelligence seminar with all the top people, all the top directorates, about dissemination of intelligence and so on. And I put my hand up and I spoke to this very robust, important audience. I said, can you tell me, we're getting all this wonderful intelligence, how is it it's all locked in a safe and never gets to the front line? And they said, Sharky, it has to be you asking a question like that. That's utter rubbish. Of course it gets to the front line. Do sit down. Well, guess what, Tim? When we went to the Falklands, HMS Invincible did not receive one word of intelligence throughout the build-up or throughout the whole war. Not one. Can you imagine that?
It's true.
No intelligence whatsoever about the position of enemy anti-aircraft systems, whether missiles or guns or anything. Not a bloody thing. Excuse the language. And so, you had to be continuously amazed and not disappointed so much as, and not really depressed, but frustrated.
Yeah.
When you were down there, at the way things were going.
And you know, you mentioned obviously you guys were you were going out, you were beating the best of the best from the USCF in their aggressor squadrons, and you know the brand new, as was then, F-15 Eagle.
Yes.
What was your biggest worry from the Argentinian sort of side of things? Was it they'd be operating Mirages from Port Stanley or their carry maker appearance, or they only seem to deploy, come out in penny packets? Would it have made a difference if they'd come out in a mass raid?
Yes, it would. First of all, with respect to Port Stanley, that didn't bother me at all in a way. It was up to the Admiral to keep us a decent distance from that if they were operating aircraft, and so we had to make sure and by reconnaissance that they weren't actually an operating fighter aircraft bomber, because we thought it was too short anyway, which proved to be the truth. But if they had operated from there, they would have been supported logistically from the mainland, and we would have been able to engage them more often, more frequently, and destroy them on the ground as well. So that wouldn't have been a problem. The best thing the Argentinians could have done would be to come out in force at the right time and take on Sea Harrier. They had listened to all my personal bullshit on in the Times and Telegraph and the Sun and whatever, and the Star newspapers, where journalists on board saying we're going to beat the hell out of them. They should have ignored all that and the history of the Sea Harrier and said, right, let's go and take out these 20 aircraft and then we'll have a free hand. They didn't do that because their staff in Argentina said, steer clear of the Sea Harrier because you'll get shot down, and we don't want you all shot down. And that was the major decision that the Argentines made that ensured that they lost the air war, because they decided not to engage the Sea Harrier in combat. Because we were much better than them anyway. We'd have shot the hell out of them. But with massive numbers, eventually we would have lost our aircraft. Indeed, you know, when Steve Thomas and I shot down the three Mirages over West Falkland, the third one was coming in behind me. I hadn't seen him firing cannon at me, and he missed, fortunately. Otherwise, that would have been one down, 19 to go. Okay. So that was their big mistake in the staff of Argentina, because the Argentine pilots were absolutely brave, decent guys, wonderful guys. And they did their best, and they did very well.
And you've been you've been known for sort of obviously frank views about Admiral Stanley Woodward, the Hermes Air Wing, and the RAF in particular. Has time made you reassess any of these?
Well, yes, I'm glad you put Sandy first, because I met him in Bottom, sort of in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, and we got on very well together, and I eventually realized that it wasn't his decision-making processes which were screwing up my squadron and the air war. It was the staff that he'd been given, who knew nothing about Sea Harrier, and the flag captain, who thought the only use for Sea Harrier was against surface targets or ground targets, and it was no good air-to-air, which is total cock. So in my revised edition to my book, I have made it very clear that Sandy was not to blame for it, and all the horrible things I might have said about him in the main text. I retracted and said, no, it wasn't him who was making stupid decisions. It was the staff and the flag captain in Hermes. And indeed, the squadron in Hermes didn't know how to use their radar properly, so that added to the problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Hermes Air Wing didn't live up to it, but they got quite a few kills because they sat above Port Stanley at 20,000 feet, not Port Stanley, San Carlos, waiting for the ships to be attacked. And then when the guys from the enemy was running away after the attack, they came down behind them and shot them down, which is a bit too late, you know, after the horses bolted.
Yeah.
Now, so my views have changed from my original book about Sandy Woodward. I think he's brilliant, and he became a very close friend. My views on the Hermes Air Wing, as was, have not changed. And on the RAF, no, they've actually grown worse. I mean, since the Falklands, all you would have heard as a layman in Britain is that the RAF won the air war in the Falklands. And you had people like Sir Peter Squire, Air Chief Marshal, Chief of the Air Staff, who was the Wing Commander Squire down on with the six Harriers in the Falklands, writing articles about the Vulcan sortie and saying that the Nimrod aircraft carried out patrols 50 miles off the Argentine coast regularly to keep the Argentine fleet inshore. Utter, complete cock. Utter rubbish. A lie that is known to be a lie, and this is what they do, the RAF, that the Nimrod never flew more than 600 miles south or away from Ascension Island throughout the war. and it was 3,000 miles to the Argentine coast. And yet here we had the chief of the air staff saying how wonderful they did, and look at what the Vulcan did. The Vulcan won the air war. Without the Vulcan, we'd have lost, which was, again, absolute cock. The Vulcan made a hole in the side of the runway and then dropped the other with the first 21 bombs. And then the next lot they forgot to arm, so they didn't go off and miss the runway anyway. And the final lot of 21 went to the west of the runway and hit nothing. So that was an absolute disaster area. And we, with the fuel that they used to drop this one bomb on the side of the runway, you could have supplied the fuel requirement for the Sea Harrier for three Falklands wars. So, you know, their bullshit about the RAF winning the air war over the Falklands is just disgraceful. And this is what they do. They say, look how good we are. Look, I mean, for example, you know, the F-3 Tornado was supposed to be defending Britain during the Cold War against Soviet bomber attack. It was never operational. That means, when I say operational, it never had a working radar and beyond visual range missile system until after the end of the Cold War. That was 13 years after it was introduced. But the Air Force were telling, in MOD, were telling Parliament in questions in the House, yes, all our aircraft are operational. You know, absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. There are many things like that, but no, my views haven't changed. And yes, I might be a bit fiery and a bit of a maverick, but I like to say the truth as it is. And there are not many occasions where that my facts have been discounted by the opposition. There's been a lot of murmuring on different blogs and websites by uneducated RAF guys saying, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. But actually, I'm the one who does. I know about carrier warfare, maritime warfare, and land-based Air Force pilots clearly don't. And that's why we're now in an awful situation, because the Royal Air Force has, God bless them, has taken control of Ministry of Defence and the ear of all the politicians and cabinet ministers. And the Navy's done nothing to stop them, nor has the Army. But the Navy in particular has done nothing to stop them, nothing effective. And so that is why they have been running, can you believe it? They've been running the carrier program and the F-35 program for the Navy, and deciding who gets what with financial things, you know. And yet they don't bugger all about maritime warfare. None of them done anything. None of them ever embarked in a carrier for more than, you know, a couple of weeks. Do I go on, Tim?
That's what we like. People get our guests coming on there and being passionate about their subjects, passionate about their air power or naval air power. You mentioned fusing. Let's go on to the next question. You mentioned sort of obviously fused bombs, and you also mentioned about having the press on the Invincible. You had the media on there. So what were your relations with the media and Operation Corporate? Because I think another Sea Harrier pilot mentioned that had the Argentinians been listening a bit more carefully to the BBC, they would have changed the fuse settings on their low-level bombs and actually sank a lot more ships.
Oh, is that Tim?
I don't know who.
Okay, but yeah, that is true. They were not delivering the weapons within the parameters of the fusing system. They were delivering it too low, and so they didn't have time for the weapons to arm some of them. So the bombs didn't explode on impact, but went straight through the ships. But what's the main tone of that question? You've probably got it written down.
What were your relations with the media on that?
They were brilliant. It was John Witherow and Tony Snow and people like that. Were absolutely great guys, and they were living in pretty abysmal conditions, mainly camp beds in different areas on the ship. And they never complained. They were very easy to talk to. The biggest strength we had in Invincible was our captain, J.J. Black, who was the best leader you could ever imagine, and was the most wonderful all our lads loved him dearly. Everybody loved him dearly. And he said to the team, he said, you know, you can report as you like, but be careful not to report anything that would endanger the fleet. And I know you like talking to Sharkey Ward. Well, that's fine until the commander-in-chief fleet at home says enough is enough. So, you know, you can get on with it. And so I could talk to them as I wanted to every day if they wanted and send reports back until word came from home that enough is enough. We'd like to keep everything quiet now. And from that moment on, they were very good. They obeyed that. They reported what they were allowed to because the captain, who was a very busy guy on board of the aircraft carrier, gave them half an hour of his time every day without fail. Can you imagine? You're at war. You're under exocet warning and things aren't going well sometimes. And yet he'll still take time to talk to the press. Well, that was brilliant. So we didn't have any radio or TV on board. They were all on board Hermes, and which is a shame, really. Sandy Woodward and the media should have been all on board Invincible with us. They'd have enjoyed it much more. We'd have had a much more successful war.
I mean, I suppose in a sense it's more easier to manage the media on board a ship where you could control the outside communications that were. Whereas today you've got social media, you've got Twitter, you've got people posting pictures of aircraft taking off from air bases. Do you think you could still, you know, how would you manage that sort of thing to, you know, today if you had a sort of a full on kind of air war against somebody and you've got that kind of sort of social media tsunami to kind of deal with?
Well, first of all, if I had the chance to control it all, I would say we're not taking any media with us. We'll give you reports from our point of view. And we'd anything else, we're going to black out. And you can't control the other media.
Yeah.
And it would have to sort of like it or lump it. And what we would do is conduct a PR exercise saying, these things are not being helpful. But, of course, the enemy is going to be using them anyway to isolate us and to confound us and whatever. So it's a very different world, very different. But I was not in favor of the media having the right to be there in the Falklands. And afterwards, I was at Greenwich Staff College, and we had a media session, and a few of my friends from the Falklands were there, media. And they were insisting that they had a right to be there, you know. Yeah. And I said, no, you bloody well don't. You don't have a right. You don't have a right to report what you think you can report. You need to clear everything. It needs to be sanitized because lives are at risk. And you have put lives at risk, like Goose Green, like you say in the press. And so I had an open argument with them in the forum at Greenwich there. And by the way, Michael Foote came to see us in Greenwich when I was a lieutenant, and he had just been made defense minister. So I remember this clearly. A friend of mine reminded me of it recently. I said, I've got a question for the minister, if I may. And the captain said, yeah, go ahead, Sharkey. I said, well, Mr. Foote, you missed a good headline when you were appointed, didn't you? Yeah, that's right. It should have read, Foot, heads, arms, body. And everyone said, sit down, Sharkey. And he didn't even understand it, Michael Floyd. He's one of these grotesque layman ministers who didn't understand bugger all.
Brilliant. So, moving on to the next question embarrassing Labour defence ministers. What lessons do you think we can take from the Falklands today about naval aviation? Some people would argue they'd say, look, that was last of the sort of Britain's, you know, imperial kind of engagements. It's never going to happen like that again. We're always going to be in a coalition. There's always going to be land bases available, etc., etc. What do you think?
Oh, I think most of what you said there is absolute nonsense. The Falklands War was indeed probably the last of the what we used to know as the conventional wars of a particular type, and the Americans well understand that, and U.S. Marine Corps friends are saying that that's that. And it left us with the lesson that if you don't have a fleet that can project air power as well as sea power and submarine power, you don't have a chance of protecting your possessions, your interests overseas. Because without the Navy, the Falklands could not have been recovered. Of course, without the Marines and the Army, the Falklands could not have been recovered either. And but to project power is nothing to do with colonialism. It's to say, look, you know, you can't do that. You can't block our trade because we rely on it. You can't block our energy because we rely on it. And for people to say, and presumably Air Force-minded people, that we can always have land bases, that's poppycock. Look at the Falklands. Nobody would give us a land them a land base to operate from. Quite the contrary. They weren't allowed to operate from anywhere in South America or South Africa. So they couldn't get near the Falklands. And if you go further far east than the Middle East and start moving out towards Afghanistan and further, if there are suddenly no friendly countries giving us a place for our air force to land and take off and operate, which would be the case out in the Malaysia Straits, etc., we wouldn't be allowed to do it there. What have you got if you haven't got a navy with decent air power and the other forms of naval power? You can't project power. And we never have been able to, and we never will be able to. Since World War II, just about every conflict around the world we've been involved in has involved naval air power coming to the rescue of situations, and indeed of RAF air power, rescuing them out of Aden and this sort of thing, and covering their backsides while they left, and all this sort of stuff. So, without a robust Royal Navy, you are up the creek without a paddle, because Britain relies on, what does it rely on? Trade, yes, 90% of it goes by sea. Energy, what is it, 40% comes by sea. If we miss three gas tankers coming into the channel and unloading, Britain shuts down. It's okay. So we have to be able to ensure that our energy supplies come to us safely, and that we have the power to say no, not to just to sort of fight, but more importantly, to deter. Ronald Reagan was saying, you know, we need an aircraft carrier, so that'll deter them. Yeah. And of course it will. And it always has. It doesn't mean that aircraft carriers are unsinkable or whatever. What it means is they have a power there that is recognizable, that Iran recognizes, for example. When they threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz, the Americans sent a carrier there straight away, and guess what? They suddenly backed down and said, oh, we'd rather negotiate than close the strait. So air power at sea is very important, and is very different from land air power on land. On land, you've got a sitting target on your airfields, and you don't have diplomatic clearance to go around the world as you want, whereas you have your complete clearance to travel in international waters wherever you like with the Navy.
Yeah.
I mean, it boggles my mind that politicians can't understand that, but when I now understand that so many of them are corrupt and are after their own future speaking engagements and whatever, rather than looking after the security of the nation, they're not interested in recent history, in military history. They're only interested in their electorate and what they can get out of it. I mean, that's a cynical way of looking at it, but that's where I've got to, really.
And one of the other things, moving on to the next question, you know, the enemy from 1982, their military is extremely run down these days. They just grounded their last fighters. They keep trying to buy replacements, but they just really haven't got the money. The UK has now got a massive military base. We've got RAF Typhoons on alert. We've got a Type 45 that kind of goes down.
Are you wearing a light blue suit?
But you've also got obviously a Royal Navy attack submarine in the area. Do you think the Falklands War could happen again?
Have we? Well, I think your premise is not absolutely hard and fast. There isn't a massive military base. There is a large airfield. On that airfield, there are three or four Typhoons, which have varying levels of serviceability and availability. And if they were put out of action, which they could easily be, either from land attack or even from other forms of attack, then you've got no air power in the Falklands. And there is no way that you can reinforce that air power rapidly without massive tanker support that we no longer have. Actually, we've got the Voyager. That can take two or four aircraft down there, but they've got to use Ascension. They've got to arrange it all. And you can't go into an unfriendly airspace with a big tanker like that so easily. So, no, we don't have massive air power down there. Look at the Navy. What has the Navy got? We've got daring destroyers, Type 45s. Where are they? Most of them are alongside. One's just returned from the Middle East and did a good commission. But they've all got problems with their propulsion units, and none of them appear to have the right, a supply of missiles on board, because we can't afford to equip them with missiles, or anti-aircraft and whatever. So, yeah, they're brilliant ships if they work. Submarines, we don't have enough submarines to keep one down in the Falklands area the whole time. There are other jobs that they have to do, like protecting our nuclear boats and so on. So, no, we do not. Your question was rather like the First Sea Lord's recent message to the world saying how good we are, we're really on top, we're doing well, which is absolute rubbish. Argentina's military is, as you say, completely run down. But if they did get a handful of aircraft and carry out a surprise attack on our airfield there, in the company with some commandos, they could easily take out the airfield, take control of it, because they could destroy our aircraft on the ground if they attacked without warning, either by commando raids or by air, if they had the aircraft. And once they got on site, there's nothing we could do to remove them as long as they had aircraft to come and protect themselves on the Falklands, which are, as you say, they don't at the moment. So I wouldn't say it's out of the question that there's another Falklands coming up. I think it'd be rather take some time. But the colleagues I have, the people I know in South America, there's still a very strong feeling that the Malvinas belong to Argentina. And it would not be out of the question for them in the future to say, all right, well, enough is enough. We're going to take it and keep it this time. And with land-based air being the prime mover in the UK now, where we spend all our money, over £350 billion spent since the 70s on land-based air and only £20 billion on fleet air arm. Can you believe? That's inflation-linked figures. We spend it all on the wrong stuff for protecting our interests around the world. And do we need to defend Europe? No, why do we need to defend Europe? We've got Germany, we've got all the different air forces, including the Polish Air Force and whatever. But French, all the NATO members, they're continental. They let them defend Europe by air and by land. Let us get on with our business and defend Britain's interests and Europe's interests on the high seas with our Navy. That's what we're here for. That's what we've been doing for centuries. And it's what they cannot do. They don't have it. Rattling on again, aren't I, Tim?
Well, no, this is great stuff. So another controversial question for you. I'm sure you've got an opinion on this. You're one of the last living British fighter aces with free kills to your name. Apart from UAVs and people firing missiles, the last manoeuvring dogfight I think happened in 1991 in the first Gulf War. So that was that was 25 years ago. So have we seen the end of the fighter pilot? Stealth long range missiles. Do that mean?
No. I understand your question. I don't think we have seen the last of the fighter pilot. By the way, I'm not an ace. An ace is somebody who's got 5 kills or more. Maybe I was helpful in winning the war. Sandy Woodward said, without my disobedience, we'd have lost the Falklands War. So that's the greatest compliment I've ever had, because Sandy was a good friend, and he used to tell friends that if I hadn't disobeyed orders, we'd have lost. So, yeah, I made a difference. But I'm not an ace. However, we've got good fighter pilots, and there are good fighter pilots around. And the advances in technology are only making it more difficult to decide a way ahead, because you have to increase your defense capability as well as your attack capability with every new bit of technology. Okay. Now, the reason why you haven't had dogfights is because we have beyond visual range missiles and good radars, Doppler radars that can look up and look down, see targets 200 miles away and engage them, getting on towards 80 or 100 miles away. That doesn't mean you don't need a pilot. How long is a piece of string? Is sort of, why do you need a pilot? A pilot can think in the air. Until you've got a computer that can think in the air, you're not on a winner. If you've got some form of, as I heard, what they call video game expert flying UAVs or out controlling them for us at inflated prices from UK and saying we're now controlling the air war, what does that tell you about these people who say this is the way we should go? Somebody with no understanding whatsoever of air warfare proper and military warfare, maritime warfare proper, controlling our aircraft from the ground, our unmanned aircraft. What do you do about alerts on deck taking on incoming, ingressing aircraft? Who thinks that problem out? Is it the untrained kid on shore in a headquarters in UK or a bunker in UK, or even a staff sergeant from the Air Force running one of those who also has virtually zero knowledge of air warfare? Or do you have a fighter pilot in the air who can decide things along with the people on the ground or on the surface ships? The Americans are very keen to, the reason why they're keeping F-18 Super Hornet are going more so than the F-35, but we'll come to that later. But they're having that is that because the F-35 requires external communication to update itself with all the required information and to pass information. If the satellites are blocked, which they may well be, this F-35 doesn't work, can't do its job. And so the U.S. Navy are wise enough to know this, and they have a two-man system that can control UAVs and also act as a link with the F-35. Whereas a one-man system or a ground-based UAV would not be able to do it, because a ground-based UAV control, that's susceptible to interference by satellite. And if you haven't got that in control, you've lost your UAV. Now, a UAV, the XB, what's it called? 46, I can't remember.
47B, yeah.
The 47B, yeah. That can take off from the River Thames on board a carrier and go and attack a target in New York and return without refueling. So you've got to send this off around the bazaars, deep strike. But if you haven't got satellite contact, you can't control it. You can tell it what to do like a Tomahawk missile, but you can't update it. And so having aircraft with people on board, there are some circumstances where it's essential, like close air support, close air support of ground forces. That often needs decision-making of the highest order by the pilot on site. Because when you come down to letting the chain of command get involved, the Air Force, it takes 2 days for them to give a decision where you have only got a few seconds. So beware of thinking that UAVs are the answer to everything. They're wonderful, and we need them in the Navy. We need them in our land forces as well, especially for deep strike, because stealth is not what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Stealth is over-egged and ain't going to work very well.
Well, that brings me on to my next question, which is, and I think you've already hinted at it there, is your opinion of the F-35B. Now, let me pull you up a little bit on this. In your rereading Sea Harrier over the Falklands, your book recently, and the way in which you had total confidence in the Sea Harrier, and the public picture was completely different. You know, people would say, "No, it's a subsonic fighter. It's going to get it's going to get clubbed to pieces in air combat." And the way in which I've spoken to U.S. Marine Corps pilots, FAA pilots, RAF pilots, USAF pilots who've flown F-35, who come back and they. They've almost got the same. It's not identical, but it's the same sort of, confidence, complete and utter confidence in it. And they can't understand the public view of it's a terrible aircraft. It's not going to work. They're going out and they're this is fantastic. We're bring on the next air war because we're going to go and dominate. Do you think maybe that we? Like the Sea Harrier 1982, that possibly that technology has moved on and that once again the pilots are right.
No, the pilots are not right because unlike them, I was not a pet poodle who told what to say and did what I was told, and I was saying what a good aircraft it was in spite of everything else. But nobody told me what to say. Well, these pilots, including the U.S. Marine Corps, are being told what to say because the U.S. Marine Corps dearly wants this aircraft. And look at it. It's nowhere near initial operational qualification. IOC, initial operational declaration. That doesn't mean it can fight. It means it can fly. They're not anywhere near the operational capability that is expected of them. So they've got up to 30 million lines of computer code, of which 75% or more is still yet unwritten. They've got all sorts of... Look, all you've got to do is read the formal congressional reports, the Auditor General of the United States, what's it called?
GAO.
Reports and the trials people's reports under the GAO. And you find you've got an aircraft that is susceptible to small arms fire, susceptible to fire damage anyway, is shortish on range compared to its opposition, has problems with stealth covering that needs weeks of maintenance every so often and taken out of service. And it's all based on a premise of this aircraft is a be-all and end-all, can do everything for everyone. Well, it actually can't. It's very poor maneuverability compared to modern jets. Its stealth, as I mentioned, is dodgy. The F-35 Stovall, which is the B version, has a very hot exhaust, and I'm not sure that it can operate vertically from our ships, so it's not going to. They're trying to make it operate with a rolling vertical landing, which is a complete nightmare of flight safety hazard. It's going to kill people doing a rolling landing onto a deck without a hook, however slow you're going, in a 30-ton, well, a 15-ton aircraft half full of kerosene. It's got so many problems. And I'm not even sure that the flight decks of the British carriers can support vertical landings, which is why we're not doing it, which means that they've been poorly designed and perhaps there's a top weight problem there. That's what people are discussing at the moment under the covers, and I'm fairly sure that that there might well be a top weight problem that has defined the configuration of the carrier flight deck, no catapults or arrestor gear, and also defined what the government's saying about, oh, we'll only embark about 12 aircraft. Perhaps because if you embark 40 aircraft, that's 40 times 15 tons. It's a lot of top weight to put on there if you're a bit dodgy already on top weight.
But that would be pretty damning from the... I mean, that would be pretty damning, not from Lockheed's point of view, but from ship designers' point of view of the...
British Aerospace Systems and MOD together, MOD Air, because they are the ones running the carrier project, and always have been, and the F-35 project. And so, you know, why did we have this U-turn away from a catapult deck? And there was no logic to it. The Americans offered to half pay for it, the conversion. And yet Cameron was persuaded by British Aerospace Systems and the RAF to go from the F-35C, the conventional carrier aircraft, to the F-35B, the Stovall. Was this because of top weight problems? We don't know, but I've just written to the Defense Committee, and they're probably not going to do anything at the moment with it because of the election coming up. But I shall pass the paper around other important people saying that, you know, we need an investigation into this. Is this how we have designed our carrier? Is that why it is going to be more capable, less capable? It will not be strike carrier capable. It will be amphibious support carrier capable with the F-35B. That's all, you know, and we won't have a strike carrier. It might be the flagship of the British Navy, but it's fairly slow. Got a lot of problems that they won't talk about. Like the Daring class has got lots of problems that they haven't talked about until later. So I am aghast at the way the Navy has been treated by the system, and the way their lordships have not stood up to be counted when necessary to say, hey, look, we need a strong Navy. This isn't going to provide a strong Navy. We need if we're having strike carriers, let's have the right sort with the right equipment on board, with the right aircraft on board.
So what would you say would be the right aircraft? What should be done? You know, if you were a magic wand was able to wave a magic wand in terms of, you know, the UK's sort of defence capability.
Well, two things really. We have these carriers now. We talk about how expensive they are, $6 billion for the two of them. You know, well, look how expensive the Typhoon is, $60 billion. Okay. And look how expensive the Voyager program is, $13 billion, twice the carriers. And what does it do? It doesn't fight, you know. So I would say if there is no top weight problem, convert them at the first refit to catapult and arrestor gear using the new system that's now been proven in the United States, the magnetic launch system. And put on board the F-18 super powered aircraft, the latest versions now being bought by the US Navy, the Hawkeye, and COD delivery aircraft, as well as some helicopters. And you've got yourself a strike carrier, because then you've got air-to-air refueling from the Super Hornet. It's got buddy-buddy refueling, whereas the F-35 hasn't. And so you can refuel on board for longer range strikes, but also you can carry the latest UAVs, the carrier launched UAVs, which can deep strike, as you've been saying, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 miles inland or away from the ship. And that would be an absolute boon as a strategic strike capability. But at the moment, we can't embark those with a ramp on the board and no arrest again.
So you'd have the X-47B as your long-range sort of stealth, you know, go out and clear the way, and then your Super Hornet to go down and do anything else then?
Well, Super Hornet for air defence. Close air support, we can give a certain level, but that's a particularly specialised art. And we've got the Warthog, which is the best in the world, but there isn't much else available at the moment. And going low level in any way in close air support is a danger, and especially if you've got an F-35 that is susceptible to one small arms bullet, possibly, you know. So, yeah, I would have a fleet of F-18s with their, what's it called, defense suppression, the Growler, you know, the Growler?
Yeah.
I'd have at least six of those on board, two squadrons of F-18s, four Hawkeyes, carry on board delivery aircraft, three of them, a helicopter plane guard helicopter, you know, for launch and recovery, and a helicopter anti-submarine unit on board as well. And suddenly you've got a strike carrier that means something. And if it can't work because of top weight, scrap these carriers and get two new ones that will work. You know? The Navy's always afraid, oh, if we scrap something like that, we'll never get another one. Well, if we need it, if the government really believes in strategic maritime power, then we get them. If they don't, we won't, you know. But no point in pussyfooting around pretending we've got something that we haven't.
Excellent. So just to wrap up now, just thinking back to the Falklands 35 years ago and then and now, is do you keep it in touch with your squadron mates and the rest of the Sea Harrier
community
that were down there?
Well, so yes and no. My best friend in life is my senior pilot down in the Falklands, Robin Kent. I keep in touch with him quite closely. And Ian Mortimer, who was one of my right arms down there at the RAF AWI. We had several AWIs in the squadron. He was one of the, he's brilliant, brilliant guy. And one or two others. But, and my squadron keeps me informed, all the lads, who I dearly love. But they're having a reunion on the 24th of June, and I'm not attending for various reasons. Maybe I'll try and make the 40th reunion if I'm not in a coffin by then. But I'm not one for going into the bar at Yeovilton if I'm in England, leaning on the bar and saying, hey, I'm Sharky Ward, can I buy you a beer?
Yeah.
I've never been into that, and I don't want to be into that because, you know, if I'm invited by somebody for a beer and a drink, that's fine, but we've got a great team of aviators in the Royal Navy, in the Fleet Air Arm, the fixed wing side as well as the rotary wing, but I'm talking fixed wing now, with people like Paul Tremelling and Adrian Orchard and others, who, some of whom have flown the horn at the F-18 on aircraft carriers, and some of whom have had a go at the F-35 and whatever. They are controlled by their bosses, but they're excellent, excellent fighter pilots. So we're not short. Well, we are short. I haven't got so many of them. We're not short of expertise.
Yeah.
We're short of the will to use that expertise. And instead of relying on land-based expertise that knows diddly shit about naval air war, we should be using these people. And the ministers should be listening to them rather than listening to the Air Warfare College at Kingston College, London.
Yeah.
Well, who know nothing about maritime warfare.
Well, hopefully these people who've been flying with the, you know, the U.S. Navy will be the core of the, you know, the F-35B operators, you know, and one day rise to be admirals who have got the clout, who have got the say, who do know how to use naval air power for the UK.
Well, yes. Yes, unfortunately, there's one last bridge to cross, and that is that the Royal Navy is not very much in favour of having aviation admirals, which is one of the reasons that I left, but also my son, who did four Sea Harrier and Harrier commissions in Afghanistan, also left the Navy because, you know, they're basically saying, well, we don't need aviators as admirals in command of the Navy. It's dreadful. I mean, this is typical narrow-minded stuff from the surface fleet that has hindered the progress of British maritime aviation in the last five decades.
Yeah. Right, on that note...
Yes. So from a man with many axes to grind, I hope I've given you what you want to know.
Shockey, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you on the show. Really, really refreshing. Great to have someone who's got forthright opinions, not afraid to hold back. where can our listeners find out more about you? Are you online? Have you got a website or something, or somewhere where people can kind of keep up to date with you?
I don't keep up to date with them. I had a website, but I mean, when you put Sharky Ward on the web, it tells you a bit about me. But really, they should just read my book, and it's on the internet. You know, it's sold by Amazon people.
So that's Sea Harrier over the Falklands, a Maverick at War, for anyone who wants to read it. Very, very good read. Well worth reading. And obviously, yeah, like you say, on Amazon Kindle now.
Yes, and if anyone wants to travel to Grenada and buy me a beer, I'm always open to a little conversation.
Brilliant. Right, well, you heard that, everybody. If you're in the Caribbean, get your signed copy there. Once again, Sean...
Bring it with you, because I don't have any copies left.
All right.
Tim, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Cheers, man. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
The Fly Navy Heritage Trust, under the brand Navy Wings, relies on public donations to restore, maintain and fly a collection of historic naval aircraft. To help the charity and the Sea Vixen, sign up as a Navy Wings supporter, donate or shop in the Navy Wings flight store. Thank you for your support.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
So, yeah, I mean that is a hard-hitting interview, as you can probably tell. Very, very privileged to have Sharky on the show, and you know, one of the last sort of, you know, British fighter pilots, I suppose. You know, would, you know, sort of, you might sort of say 35 years ago. But you know, he's pretty outspoken in his views, isn't he?
Do you know what I really like about what he had to say is his honesty and his determination in making things better. And although, you know, I've got a copy of the book here in front of me, and of course the term Maverick creeps in, but what he fights for what he believes in. And I've seen recently some work that he's done in trying to influence the current air power issues at the MOD. He really, really hasn't given up. But fascinating interview, Tim. So many issues that come out of it. But ignoring his court-martial for low-flying and driving around in a Rolls-Royce, we'll have to get him back on from his house in Grenada sometime to tell us all about that. And I know, you know, the internet wasn't around and digital technology wasn't around, but some of the points he made about nobody reading any of the reports on the Sea Harrier, complete and utter lack of intelligence, zero intelligence for these guys to go into war with was is quite astonishing.
Yeah, and I think that just going back to the interview on the previous episode with Tim Gedge, how a so-called expert could turn up and say to them that they thought that all of the Sea Harriers would be shot out of the sky within 2 days, and that was basically from a complete lack of knowledge of the various capabilities of the Sea Harriers and of the forces they were fighting against. So yeah, it was just the sort of the lack of joined up thinking, the lack of sharing of intelligence is there were obviously very big issues back then. I think some of them probably were dealt with afterwards. Through the lessons being learned, but yeah, it was quite sort of shocking stuff, really.
Yeah.
Do you think we've solved that? Do you think we've? I mean, obviously, there's inter-service rivalry. There's banter that goes on. Do you think we're past that now? Or you know, I mean, to take an example, you know, you've got FAA pilots going to be embedded in the first F-35B squadron, 617 squadron that will have naval pilots in it. I'm sure there'll be RAF pilots embedded in the next FAA squadron flying F-35B. Do you think that we've put that inter-service rivalry where behind us now, or do you think that might kind of flare up again if there was some kind of crisis and people were, you know, had their lives on the line and found out, oh, hang on, where's my intelligence from?
I think for me, though, Tim, the amazing thing is that they still succeeded, even though they had political, with a small p, challenges. They had challenges with supply lines. And for anyone who's read Commander Ward's book, you know, the fact that they'd asked for things like paint to repaint the aircraft to grey, you know, things like that. They had to beg, steal and borrow, you know, the fact that the AIM-9s were not arriving when they should have. I mean, when you put all those things together, the sheer determination of people like Commander Ward and Commander Gedge to make these things happen is probably such a fine line between success and failure. It's quite amazing.
I think it's sometimes said that sometimes the forces like the Fleet Air Arm almost don't do themselves any favours because they are so good at actually making the best of what they've got and managing to cobble together a really effective solution from what really should be inadequate resources, that actually it's too easy to sort of send them off with inadequate kit. But it's, you know, as well as all that, you know, the sort of system level stuff. But I think the part of the faction of the Falklands was they did learn very, very quickly, and they had the people in the right places, you know, down in the South Atlantic to actually make it all work. And I wonder actually if some of it was the fact that they were halfway around the world and that far from that far from the MOD, that they were actually able to sort of, you know, should put a bit more initiative into practice.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things that sort of that struck me about Sharkey Ward's sort of total change in attitude to Sandy Woodward. And in a sense, it doesn't surprise me from reading so much of what they've both written that ultimately they got on and actually understood each other, because they're very similar characters, and they're those kinds of characters that the Navy has a sort of a habit of throwing up when they're needed, of people who just know what needs to be done and can get on with the job and cut through all the red tape and BS to actually get it done. And that's what happened.
Yeah. And what was that comment? We wouldn't have won the war without your disobedience.
without my disobedience, we'd have lost the war. Yeah.
That is such a cracking line.
I mean, I also have a question, and maybe somebody here, Matt, maybe you know more as well. Is and I didn't, unfortunately, didn't kind of pick him up on that, but you know, he was saying about Nimrods being operated off the coast of Argentina, and which is kind of one of those secret bits of history where, and I think it was, but you know, it was in a sort of academic history that came out by a distinguished professor that there had been some sort of spy flights, and it had been the reason why obviously nobody had been told about it because we'd used sort of Chilean air bases. That's why it was ultra hot, you know, top secret, and no one could breathe a word about it, including also, I think, the idea of sending Canberras down to Chile as well, which some kind of sharp-eyed journalist had also spotted, a Canberra PR9 being somewhere where it shouldn't be.
Yeah. And that's all still very, you know, there is still no official account of exactly what's going on other than denial. So I think that it ranges from the official line of nothing to see here through to, you know, there were air crews down in Chile flying reconnaissance missions from there. And I guess we won't know the truth behind that for a very long time, but I mean, what he said about the Nimrods not flying more than 600 miles from Ascension, I was very surprised by that, actually. I would like to sort of look into that further, because I know there was sort of, with the Black Buck missions, it was the Nimrods were actually used to sort of help link up the Vulcans with the Victor tankers on the way back, but I have to say I don't know exactly whereabouts over the South Atlantic that took place. So it's definitely some things there that will bear further looking into, and some very interesting stuff that might come up.
Tim, Matt, both Commander Gedge in our last episode and Commander Ward in this episode made a lot of unscripted. We didn't talk to them or ask them what their views were about the F-35, but made it very clear development of what we are now seeing coming into service around the world now was started as a result of their work, particularly with the Sea Harrier.
Yeah. And yet, I think the fact that they're, well, not so much Tim Gedge, but certainly Sharkey Ward appearing to be very, very critical of the current aircraft. So it is interesting. But obviously, that process started quite a long time ago in you know, the next generation follow up to the Sea Harrier, and I suppose we will find out in due course as to whether it's what everyone hopes it will be. I think, again, because of the fact that it's such a large aircraft, the heat of the exhaust and so on, how you won't be able to do things like stick them aboard something like an Atlantic conveyor. So I think if we were to fight something like the Falklands with F-35s, we wouldn't have the sort of flexibility that we did with the Sea Harrier. But on the other hand, it's the data synthesis and so on that you get with the F-35 is going to be just light years ahead of where the Sea Harriers were. So no, it's an interesting business.
I mean, that was another interesting thing from Sharkey about, you know, could the Falklands War happen again? And obviously the Argentine Air Force, Argentine Navy is much more, you know, they're just flat broke. But you've got now a nice long runway. You've got built up, you've got a garrison. So, you know, the I think the thing that sort of missed here really is okay, you know, you could sort of say, well, there's a window of opportunity and we're going to have CVF next year, and they better hurry up if they're going to do it, because, you know, they're not going to have much time to.
Do it.
But we haven't
very much like it was. You're not, or, you know, with similarities to 1982, when the fact that we were about to sell Invincible to the Australians, you know, Illustrious wasn't due to appear until the middle of 1983. Hermes was. I'm not sure what the plans were for Hermes, but I don't think she was going to be in service very much longer. So whether actually, you know, they could have timed it better for their operation and caught us really on the hop. And again, as Sharkey Ward was pointing out, the resources that we're relying on to defend the islands at the moment, you know, there are a lot of potential issues with those, with the the Type 45s that if everything and the Typhoons, if everything happens, if everything works as advertised, they'd be able to defeat the entire Argentinian fast jet force with one arm tied behind their back. But the likelihood of everything happening as it should do is
yeah
well, well I mean yeah
Yeah, I mean, you look at the fly that's down there, you know, top four typhoons. You think, oh, well, that's four typhoons. You know, that doesn't sound too much. But then, that's what we're deploying to, you know, the Baltics, for example, as part of a Baltic defense package, and that's going against serious, no kidding, Russians as a tripwire as to, hey guys, you know, you're the first to die should SU-30s and SU-35s and everybody else come streaming west.
Yeah.
So, it, in a sense, four typhoons down there is to my mind is a little bit overkill.
It ought to be a pretty big deterrent, sure. Yeah.
And just going back to Commander Ward's views about combat air patrols and how they were delivered, something that came up in the interview with Commander Croft, the Lynx pilot, in the last episode, and Sharky Ward does talk about it, and that's the differences between the operations of the Hermes and the Invincible, and particularly the two Sea Harrier squadrons, the differences in the way that they operated.
Sharky was in favour of low-level patrols, caps along the threat axis, you know, using the radar to look out at as far as possible, and also to sort of sanitise the sea. You know, he was a gas that the Hermes were using this, obviously, here is for kind of a visual sea search, you know, sort of World War II stuff. But to get down low and work out where these low rays are coming in, and then you'd actually, you know, quite a bit of the time, apparently, the fact that a Sea Harrier radar popped up on their radar warning receivers, they'd turn around and they'd scarper, because their instructions were at one point is do not engage Sea Harriers, because they've been getting shot down. So that was a sort of an important deterrent. Also, you were down there low, and he was criticizing Hermes because they were keeping their caps high, and thus they had the element of speed to kind of jump on the bandits down low. But by the time they'd actually sort of seen them, the attack aircraft, Skyhawks, Mirages, what have you, Daggers, were down among the ships, you know, especially sort of San Carlos.
Yeah.
So he was very, very, critical of that they should have been low level and should have been kind of making more effort to meet them, you know, down low.
Just from, I suppose, those lessons learnt, how did the Fleet Air Arm and any of the other forces, because this conflict was watched eagerly, particularly afterwards in terms of tactics, how were the differing tactics moved on from there? What lessons did we learn from whether Commander Ward was right or whether the flights from Hermes were right in 800 Squadron?
Well, I think probably ultimately history bore out Sharky Ward's vision slightly more, in that the plan as was intended and as 800 Squadron were fitting in with, was that there would be a kind of box around the fleet and the amphibious land, you know, the amphibious operations area, that would extend out to a certain distance and up to about 10,000 feet, and within that area that would be dealt with by missiles, and anything outside that would be dealt with by the Harriers. So the notion was that they would, that the Harriers would try and catch them before they came in, and if they couldn't do that, then they'd be waiting for them to come out again. But obviously, with the performance of the missiles, there was more of a sense that and actually the fact that the Sea Harriers, the fighters, really did work. So I think there was a sense that they needed a better radar, they needed something with better look down, shoot down, they needed to be able to carry more missiles. I mean, if you look at also at the modifications that were made to the Harrier carriers afterwards, initially they had a Sea Dart launcher forward, and that had sort of compromised the flight deck, and it had compromised the angle of the ski jump. And after the Falklands, they were rebuilt. They had the Sea Dart launcher taken away. They had the ski jump angle increased. Ark Royal was, I think, built like that, and the other two ships were modified. So I think it very much put things back into the sense that for air defense, you can't beat an interceptor if equipped with good missiles and good radar. So I think that was the lesson that was initially learned, and I think was true right through to about through to the retirement of the Sea Harrier FA2s, actually. And then after that, we've kind of come back in that we don't have a you know, we don't have an interceptor anymore, but that was very much how things progressed in the years immediately following the conflict.
I'd love to get Commander Ward back on the show to hear not only more of his views, but some more of those stories. And we do apologise just for the quality of the line there. He does reside in Grenada in the Caribbean, and the internet line was pretty poor. We've done the best we could to clean that up, but hope it didn't spoil your interest in that interview. Okay, let's leave our review there and move on. I'm just going to play you a little piece of an interview from some archives that are being released by the Royal Aeronautical Society. And we just want to promote some of their work that's going on at the moment. But this brief cut out of an interview with Captain Eric Winkle Brown reflects some of the views that Commander Ward shared with us a little earlier. Now, this was recorded, I believe, in 1978, so not far off from when the Falklands were. So it's a little taster. I think it adds a little bit of value to this programme in terms of some of the views that have been shared. But also, we'd like to encourage you to go over to the Royal Aeronautical Society and listen to some of their archived material coming out.
I think the Navy has always had two basic crosses to bear.
Yeah.
One is that the senior officers in the Royal Navy have never fully accepted aviation as being an inherent necessity in any navy. They may regard it as a useful weapon to have around, but they are not prepared to say that anybody who becomes a professional in this specific area is good enough to be a career officer in the Royal Navy. If you want to examine some basis for my saying this, if you look through the records of naval staff, I mean personalities in the naval staff for many years, from 1930s right through, you rarely find anybody with wings on their sleeve on the naval staff at all. But they did begin to get them in there recently, it was too late. The only first Sea Lord we ever had wearing wings was Caspar John, and he, great man as he was, arrived there because the Sea Lord immediately ahead of him died of a heart attack after being only months in the chair. So it was in some ways providence that guided Caspar into the chair. Thank God it did, because he looked like putting the naval air right back up into the top league again. And we were all set fair to get into the top league with this wonderful new carrier, the CVA-01, which would have come into service. And all the design work and planning was done under the aegis of Caspar John. Then, just as he retired from the Navy, we had a change of government and the whole thing collapsed. This is a way that politics plays such an important part in it. But getting back to why, as I say, that's the first big cross the Navy's had to bear, the non-acceptance of a professional body of men who have a full career to enjoy in the Navy if they're associated with aviation. The other thing is, there has always been, although it's often smoothed over, the fact is that there has always been a professional jealousy between the Fleet Air Arm and the Air Force. The Air Force took over the Fleet Air Arm at one stage. They ran the Navy's naval aviation in the 30s. They gave it up very reluctantly. They hankered after ever since. They regard themselves like a certain amount of, positive argument that they should control everything that flies. This is rather the Goering attitude to the in this situation. This was the same in Germany, the Luftwaffe. And as a result, they have never been very helpful to helping the Navy to keep its aviation head above water. Recently, of course, you'll see we've gone the full turn of the wheel. We look like getting what might be called mini carriers back over the disguise with the name of through-deck cruisers now. But many of the aircraft on them are going to be, the fixed-wing aircraft, are going to be flown by people in light blue.
Really?
Oh, yes. And indeed, the Buccaneers and the Phantoms had a number of crews recently, and as recently as the Ark Royal, which were light blue. So there's still this tendency to revert back. And if you look at it, it's not, it goes across the board. It also permeates into the army. The RAF's relationship with the army up to a point is the same, because the army got into the light spotting aircraft. Nobody was too interested in that. They were rather regarded as a sort of small flying club in that sense. But then they became serious users of helicopters. And sure enough, the RAF managed to persuade the powers that be that there should be a weight limit imposed on the kind of helicopter the army should operate. So anything above a given weight is in the RAF's field.
So like the Pumas.
That's correct. So the army are restricted to the lightweight helicopters. Now, I can't believe that this is the best solution. I've heard the arguments pro and con, but possibly what worries the RAF is there was at one time a strong body that thought there should be no RAF at all. There should only be an army with its own air wing and a navy with its own naval wing. And this is, of course, reverting back to the situation that existed in the United States before the last war. I am not a supporter of that. I don't go as far as that by any matter of means. But I think there is room for a bit more give and take between the three services. And I would like to see more cooperation at high level. At working level, there is all the cooperation in the world. All the cooperation in the world. There is no problem at all when it gets down to squadron level. It's when you get up into the echelons of Whitehall that the problems start. And it was ever thus, I suppose it always will be. If you look throughout history, I mean, this isn't a new phenomenon at all. There's professional jealousy in every walk of life. In the services, it is possibly particularly strong because it's almost motivated by a fight for survival. When you have a budget, a defense budget, which has got to be sliced up, this really fosters professional jealousy when they're all fighting for a slice of the cake.
Okay, that's it then. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd like to say a special thank you to Lewis Gaylard for helping us produce this episode, and you can find Lewis's latest book, Sea Vixen XP924 Foxy Lady, at the Navy Wings store. We'd also like to thank the BBC and Smithsonian Channel for the use of their content. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, poddirectory.com, and of course iTunes. If you've enjoyed this show, please leave us some feedback on whatever podcatcher you play. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Okay, Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at RES Tim R on Twitter, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
Gareth, how about you?
Gareth _ Stringer on Twitter and globalaviationresource.com. And I just wanted to say a huge, huge well done to you, Peter, and your good self, Tim, and Matt, thank you so much for joining us. For various reasons, I've actually had very, very little to do with these two episodes, and they are absolutely brilliant. Very well done.
You're part of the team. It's a team effort. Team extended. Now, Matt, where can we find out about you online?
I'm at Naval Air History on Twitter, and navalairhistory.com is the website.
Okay, you can find me, everything Nascot Hornet, on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and we're keen to do a further episode on the Falklands Air War, but from an Argentine perspective. We'll let you know how this develops. Finally, before we leave you, this episode is dedicated to those who lost their lives in this conflict from all sides of the campaign. Those who never returned gave their lives for a cause they believed in. They will not be forgotten. Okay, and with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Matt Willis.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye for now.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extend it.
This is XTP Media.